From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The second woman to ever serve on the United States Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has died, shocking the nation. After a lengthy battle with metastatic pancreatic cancer, the feminist icon and trailblazing jurist passed away on Friday at 87, leaving behind one dying wish that her replacement would be chosen until after a new president was elected. But within hours of her death, Republican senators began expressing glee and planning a replacement to be voted on in lightning speed. Typically, it takes several months for a president to pick a nominee and for the Senate to hold hearings and a vote. The election is less than 50 days away. Joining me to discuss her legacy and the political battle brewing to fill RGB's seat is Corey Brettschneider, professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, as well as The Oath in the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. His latest book, published September 8th, is Decisions and Dissents of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Selection. Welcome, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali. It's a sad occasion, but I'm happy to talk about the importance of Justice Ginsburg's legacy for all of us. And it's a time of mourning, but it's also a time of celebration of this amazing life.
So there were vigils all around the country at courthouses. Certainly the political battle about who is to replace her looms large, and she too understood it, given what she said to her granddaughter just days before she passed away. But let's focus on her legacy and what she achieved. What are the decisions? And she was known for her scathing and eloquent dissents, but what are the decisions that you can really attribute to her?
I think the true victory, the reason why she is often and rightly compared to Thurgood Marshall as one of the most important litigators and justices of our country's history, is her decision in the women's rights case about the Virginia Military Institute. That is really a culmination of her entire life's work. She began as a litigator with a simple idea, which was that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, although it was passed after the Civil War, and was focused and intended to rectify inequality based on race, the same principle applied to inequality based on gender, or what she often called as sex. The principle, she said, was that you can't allow arbitrary discrimination against people for attributes that don't limit their ability. And what better example of that than the right of women to attend a military academy? There were women, she argued, who were more than able, certainly intellectually capable and physically able, to attend that academy. And it was discrimination and a violation of our Constitution that public institution didn't allow it. She went from litigating cases about that topic to deciding one that really solidified her rightful view that under our Constitution, women cannot be denied equal protection of the laws.
So she was someone whose presence on the court was also seen as a bulwark against attacks on the Roe versus Wade decision to ensure that abortion remains a constitutional right. Is there a body of work or dissenting opinions that you can look back on to capture her position on reproductive rights for women?
There was a case that she litigated, actually, when she was at, I believe, the ACLU, called Strzok, that was about a woman in the military was basically denied the right to have an abortion absent penalties from that institution. And she argued vigorously in court, the lower courts, that this was a denial also of the equal protection of laws. And that opened up her approach, the way that she really saw this issue, until the day she died, which was that the way to really conceive of abortion was as an equality issue, that denying women, you know, it's only women who get pregnant, and so denying them this procedure is a discrimination based on sex and gender, and it shouldn't be allowed. Now, the court didn't go in that direction. They relied on a more general right of privacy, individual liberty right. And even though she disagreed with it, she thought the right was so essential that she didn't let her kind of squabble with the reasoning get in the way of being a vigorous defender of Roe. as a member of the court. And that meant that in Casey, when the court upheld things like a 24-hour waiting period, and in other cases where the court tried to limit abortion rights, she was vigorously dissenting from them.
Now, Justice Ginsburg was the second woman to be on the court after Sandra Day O'Connor. After her, of course, came Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor. There have been only four women on the court. She was also Jewish. She died on Rosh Hashanah. How significant was that?
I think when she talked about that, you know, it was another perspective. Our Constitution at its best is about the protection of minority rights. And the idea that what a democracy is not just the ability of a majority to impose its will on a minority. Certainly what it's not is handing over all power to a president who's then all powerful. And that sort of empathy, that thought about minority rights was partly, I think, captured by her experiences as a woman. She talked often about experiences that she had as a student and certainly as a young lawyer trying to get hired, facing discrimination. And so she knew, not just at an abstract and intellectual level, what equal protection of the law meant for women, but as a personal experience. And I think that Judaism probably informed that as well, that experiencing America and the Ivy League as a Jewish woman probably carried with it a sense of being different and the sense of the importance of religious minorities. But what was great about her was that, of course, like all great civil rights heroes, she took those individual experiences based on religion, based on discrimination, based on gender, and extended it to issues where she was not facing discrimination. And she was a terrific defender of African-American civil rights, in particular the right to vote. So her dissent in the Shelby County decision, which really rightly and vigorously goes after the majority for stripping the 1965 Civil Rights Act of its power, the coverage formula that said if you're going to change voting rules and you have a history of discrimination in areas specifically like adding requirements of ID, even though there's no evidence that people are cheating, suppressing the vote, the court struck down the part of that act that required oversight from the Department of Justice, and she really came at it with as much vigor as she did in these other areas and said, she wasn't a black woman, but she said, this is pure discrimination, pure denial of the idea of equal rights. And, a civil rights hero doesn't just defend the minorities of which he or she is a part, but of all. And
She did come under some criticism for an opinion that she shared a few years ago about Colin Kaepernick and his kneeling protest during the national anthem. She called it dumb and disrespectful. A lot of people said that was one of the few places where she sort of countered her, undermined her own liberal legacy. And there were some other issues on Palestinian rights as well. Certainly she was not perfect. A few people are. One of the points of criticism that really becomes relevant today is that people have looked back on the time when she could have been replaced very easily by a Democratic president had she chosen to retire when both President Obama was in the White House and the Senate was controlled by Democrats, and she chose to power through. What do you make of that criticism?
I think, you're right. She wasn't perfect. I think the legacy that I'm talking about in the book, and that's why I really focus on the decisions and dissents of the Supreme Court that she wrote, her work as a litigator, those were her finest hours. Now, when you're in the public eye, as long as she has, you say things that are wrong. And certainly I do not agree with what she said about the protests, which were essential to generating the most important social movement of our time, Black Lives Matter. I do think that those are remarks that she was making, and it's different than the considered decision of a judge.
That wasn't part of her a dissent she wrote, nor an opinion she wrote for the court.
Yeah, I think I would, Justice Kennedy, who has a true mixed legacy in that he was the pioneer of the gay rights jurisprudence, and at the same time, in the travel ban case, really abandoned the idea of minority rights, and probably the most important moment in his career, when we were faced with a despotic president. I have no problem with saying that he really tarred his legacy and undermined it. Whereas I would say these remarks are wrong and, you know, should be criticized and condemned. But thankfully, they were not things that she did as a justice. And I do think that's a distinction. Right.
What about the decision to remain on the court and risk exactly the moment we find ourselves in today, which is where not just a Republican president, but a Republican president like Trump is going to try all he can to replace her with as right-wing and as young a judge as possible. She did have the chance to retire and have her replacement be picked by a Democrat, but she chose to not do so.
I agree with you. I think that was a terrible error of judgment. I would not call it a moral failing as much as a failure of knowledge, which many of us had. I think that there was a confidence in that last election that this real joke of a candidate, and he was a joke of a candidate in the sense that he was not to be taken as a morally serious person, couldn't win. And we were naive, many of us. I mean, I didn't believe Trump was going to win. And I think that's just what she thought, that she could keep going on and fighting that fight. And, she didn't know who she was going to be replaced with. I think she wanted somebody on the court that was going to continue the fight, especially for women's rights, which, the ERA still hasn't been passed. And the gains that we've had are largely due to her. And I think that's what she imagined. Now, she was just wrong, as many of us were. She should have stepped down. Absolutely.
So Hypocrite Mitch is a hashtag that's trending. And of course, that refers to what happened in the last year of Obama's office. It was the summer, I believe, of 2016 when Justice Antonin Scalia, right-wing justice, unexpectedly died. And Obama put forward Merrick Garland to replace him. And Republicans who controlled the Senate, led, of course, by Mitch McConnell, fought tooth and nail, pulled out all the stops, rolled out every argument possible to insist that Obama had no right to replace a justice on the court, even though he did. And, Mitch McConnell, of course, doesn't care. But Lindsey Graham actually said, you can use my words against me. And he laid out a scenario that is eerily exactly what we have today. And I want to actually play for you and our audience Lindsey Graham's words in 2016, before we come back to you, Corey, with a sense of where the Republicans are today. This is Lindsey Graham talking about why Merrick Garland should not be nominated by or confirmed to the Supreme Court in 2016.
This is the last year of a lame duck president. And if Ted Cruz or Donald Trump get to be president, they've all asked us not to confirm or take up a selection by President Obama. So if a vacancy occurs in their last year of their first term, guess what? You will use their words against them. I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination. And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right.
That is Senator Lindsey Graham saying that you can use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right. Corey Bretschneider, the hypocrisy is quite stunning, isn't it?
Oh, it's outrageous. I mean, and it has a gaslighting quality to it where they said you can't hold these hearings for a nominee of the Supreme Court in a presidential election year. It's a presidential election year. And now they're going back and saying, well, throughout history, we've had these hearings. And it's beyond hypocrisy. It's a kind of gross lying to the American people. And it's about pure power, the idea that they'll even couch it in principle is an insult, and it really is a insult to the intelligence of the American people. That is a stolen seat. That's the way to refer to what happened to Garland, and Democrats have to do absolutely everything they can to stop this appointment from happening before the election. If we fail to do so, rightfully we'll engage in a discussion about whether we need to add a 10th justice to reclaim that stolen seat.
Let's talk about that. That's a really critical part that I think is not as well known. The fact that there is no specification in the Constitution that there be only 9 seats on the Supreme Court. And I understand there's also no aspect of the Constitution that suggests that justices serve for their entire lifetime or until they choose to retire on the Supreme Court, right?
There's definitely no number of justices that are specified. It's specified through Congress, and through an act of Congress, it can be changed. And we've actually had different numbers throughout American history. The practice has differed. And this isn't the first time that we've talked about increasing the number, specifically to alter the court's view when it's gone off the rails. The other time that this happened was Franklin Roosevelt threatened to pack the court during the New Deal when his legislation was being shut down, and he didn't pack the court. Now, why didn't he do it? There are differing theories, but one thing that we know happened is the court started upholding the New Deal. We're talking about things like minimum wage legislation, workers' rights legislation, the National Labor Relations Board was at stake, the New Deal itself. And as the court got more sympathetic to Roosevelt, he stopped threatening it. Now, that's a very controversial moment in American history. But what we have now that we didn't have then was a Senate that was really playing fast and loose with their constitutional obligation. They were obligated to, they could have voted Garland down, but refusing to have hearings was a real dereliction of duty. Now, what do you do when there's a dereliction of duty? Some people will say two wrongs don't make a right, but I think it has to be on the table to think about adding that 10th seat, maybe adding Garland himself.
Right. And then there has been an effort to impose term limits on justices as well, lengthy term limits, but term limits nonetheless, because, of course, the two justices that Trump has had a chance to get onto the court, both Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, are relatively young. That means that they, are going to be on the court for decades. He's considering a number of people. Likely he's going to appoint somebody or offer somebody up who is extremely young. Amy Coney Barrett is one name, a very young woman. That means that, a 6-3 conservative tilt to the court could be set in stone for a long time, or until, someone like Clarence Thomas might retire or pass away, yeah, or some of the other conservative justices that are older. And so, this seems to be a very, very critical issue, right?
I guess my view is it is possible. Look, if we could avoid packing the court in this, what will hopefully be a new administration, we should. And one thing might make sense is to wait and see how, whether they go the way of the court during the New Deal and don't interfere with the progressive agenda of this new president, what will hopefully be a progressive agenda. But if they do interfere, for instance, one of the main things, if they say that it's unconstitutional to enact Obamacare or related healthcare proposals, then I think we're in the realm of needing to pack the court. Or if they were to say, not just that Roe v. Wade isn't good law, which I think they will say, but that we can't pass national legislation to protect the right to an abortion, one of the first things that we should do if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, then I think the argument gets very compelling for court packing. So I'm not totally sure yet, but it's on the table right here.
And of course, doing that sort of thing requires a bold president. If Joe Biden wins the election, unfortunately, he is very much a centrist establishment Democrat whose hallmark has been caving, lacking a spine, going with the flow and allowing Republicans to run roughshod over them. They don't play dirty or even aggressively when faced with Republicans doing the same. And so it's certainly a big risk. Let's talk about the numbers needed. If Trump does put forward a nominee, and he said he's going to do so Friday or Saturday of this week, and if it were to actually be somebody who's confirmed or even with hearings held, it would be an incredibly, incredibly fast process to begin with. And I understand that, of course, because of the Democrats, changing the rules, which has now come back to haunt them, Republicans just need a simple majority. That means they just need 51 votes on the Senate. So they have 53 seats. And if you want to overcome Vice President Mike Pence's tie, the Democrats need all of them to keep, you know, to vote against this nominee. They also need four Republicans to switch parties, to switch party allegiances, right?
Right. And, you know, that's possible. And it's the first thing to do is to try to stop this nomination, this consideration of putting this nominee on the court. And we've got Susan Collins and Murkowski saying that they won't support putting this nominee up. And Romney is a possible third. There's also this Arizona Senate race. So if a Democrat wins that, that might be a fourth vote.
And that's right. The special election in Arizona, results of which could be, a Democrat could be seated November 30th.
That's right. And so delaying until then and then having the fourth seat that way, Cory Gardner is another possibility. But I do think that the strategy right now is maximum pressure on those senators, on those close races where, you know, they don't want to lose their seats. And so make them see that choosing Trump is a loss of their seat. There's no self-gain in it. The only reason to support Trump in the first place for them would be self-gain. And so if we as citizens can make it clear that's not going to happen, I think that's the most immediate thing that we can do. And of course, that would avoid, I think, having to really get into this stuff about court packing and more radical action.
Right. And so if you have, and Mitt Romney's made it very clear, he is in the anti-Trump side of the Republican column. If he were to join Murkowski and Collins, we would really just need one other Republican who might be feeling the pressure, you know, and it could be in any number of folks who are facing close races. But and it could be the Arizona elected person as well. But what about Democrats? Is it safe to say that all Democrats, including, say, a Doug Jones or Joe Manchin, will stand firm because they too face close races?
I know. I mean, it's a frightening thought, but the idea that, you know, this is the single most important vote these people will take in their entire career. And, you know, give me a break. You cannot try to save your seat at the expense of the future of the American people. We're talking about gay rights, the right to privacy, the right to abortion, voting rights, the future of America to be a democracy. If any of them even consider voting to push this nominee forward, they're no longer Democrats in any sense, and there has to be severe retaliation at the poll.
And also, we have to remember that a presidential term, if Trump were to lose this election, his term would end not on November 3rd, not on December 31st, but on January 20th. So even if he were to lose the election, it is still possible, if he has the votes in the Senate, that he could appoint a justice as he's leaving his seat, his position in the White House.
I think that's possible. You know, this is a person who wants to hang on to power at all costs. You know, I guess one thing, hopefully, is I think if he loses, he's such a narcissist that he'll be so despondent. My hope is that he'll give up. And, you know, I don't think he cares about the future of the Supreme Court. None of these issues matter to him. The idea that he's really a pro-life president is a joke. So I think, you know, if he loses, let's just hope that his sense of self-destruction is so strong. He's facing criminal charges, for instance, that he'll give up. The one thing, unfortunately, that he might be thinking is that if he can put an ally there, then maybe there's some way through a court challenge of what might be the inevitable criminal prosecution he faces, that he'll have some allies on the Supreme Court.
And we know that he thinks that way because he thought that one of his relatives, name now escapes me, on a federal judicial post would be a feather in his cap, you know, some ally that he could count on. We know that that's how he thinks. He's even, by the way, said on Saturday in North Carolina, he said that, you know, he thinks that the outcome of the election itself could be something that federal courts could step in to decide.
And let's not forget, you know, we were talking about RBG's legacy. One of the things that I highlight in the book, and she read this Dissent from the Bench, and so I recommend the audiobook on this to listen to her words spoken, is Bush v. Gore. And what she essentially said is that was a lawless decision. The Supreme Court was faking it when they said with an insult to her and her jurisprudence that this was about equal protection of the law and equal votes in the Electoral College's official process. No, it was a partisan decision where Republican justices, Scalia leading them, put a Republican president in that Oval Office. And that could happen again. That's the danger. And I think her legacy is, let's read that dissent and see that we've got to stand up to a lawless court if it does such a thing. And I'll tell you, if they do that, then there's no question again. Bush v. Gore should have, you know, brought retaliation against those justices for what they did. And if they do it again, they've really lost any ability to call themselves a law court. They're a despotic group of actors if they try to put the next president on the court.
Well, stakes have never been higher, perhaps. Corey, thank you so much for joining us today. We will post a link to your website and also information about your latest book on RGB. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for celebrating her life with me.
My guest has been Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University. His books include When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, and The Oath in the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. His latest book, just published, is Decisions and Dissents of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Selection. We've been discussing, in addition to her legacy, the political battle to replace her on the Supreme Court. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.